Good. Let me say, first of all, that I'm very happy to be here, and also with all the other seminar leaders. We know this is a major challenge because you have seven other seminars always to choose from. So if we don't behave ourselves and don't perform, you will go to another seminar, and you have, as if that weren't enough, you've got picturesque landscapes around here and beautiful sunshine, so we will do our very best to keep you interested. And I also want to use this opportunity to thank very much the organizers. I'm immensely impressed by the organization. It's been really terrific the way it's all been working out. And I don't know how you or some of you managed in 1945 to get this thing going. I mean, what I know about 1945, this is a miracle. Anyway, speaking of magic, so now about justice. Let me start with a little bit of dry philosophy about justice. Justice isn't a thing in the world, but justice is a predicate of things, a property of things. And in particular, you know, normally when you have empirical properties, properties like a car being a car, if you know the definition of the word, and if you know all the empirical facts about the world, then you can decide whether something is a car or not. But with evaluative predicates, it's not so easy. With evaluative predicates, two people can completely agree on what the definition of a word is, what the word justice means, and they can also agree on all the empirical facts, and they can nevertheless disagree about whether a particular object has the property of justice. People have theoretical or normative disagreements about justice, and this is what a lot of the courses that we will be teaching here will be about. Normative disagreements, where people disagree about what the word justice means, agree more or less about the facts, but differ about what justice requires or what justice judges about these facts. Now, the predicate just, unjust is applied to mainly four different judicanda, as you might call them, four different types of objects to which that term is applied. The first is individual and collective agents. We say of a judge that she is just, or of a politician perhaps, and so on. Secondly, the conduct of individual and collective agents can be said to be just or unjust. A particular verdict, a particular war can be just or unjust. Thirdly, social rules can be just or unjust. Social rules, social institutions, the rules that structure our social systems, our societies. And finally, it's also often said that states of affairs are just or unjust. For example, that some people are very good looking and others are not, some are bright, others are not, some are very musical, as we just saw, and others lack the talent for music. That also could be said to be just or unjust. I will, in this lecture, focus on the third of these, on social justice. And social justice is a property of social institutions, of rules and practices, the kinds of things that structure our social institutions, our social life. This is a topic that has been around in Europe quite a long time, but Rawls became quite famous for reinventing it in the Anglo-American theater, focusing on institutions and saying that we have to think much more than we have done before about how our society is structured and how the structure of our society, the basic rules, have an important influence in shaping not only our prospects, not only how much each of us has by way of rights and freedoms and liberties and opportunities and income and wealth, but also even who we are, who we become through the education system, for example, and through the families in which we grow up. So it's a hugely important topic to think about the basic institutions of social systems and the profound effects they have on our chances and also on our very identity. Now, as I said, there are many different conceptions of justice, so people disagree about exactly what a society has to be like in order to count as just. But in order to not bore you with lots of details about what different theorists have thought about that question, let's start with something relatively minimal. Most people, however much they disagree about what justice is in detail, agree that in order to be just, a society, a system of social rules, has to at least fulfill human rights insofar as that's reasonably possible. It's not always reasonably possible. There may not be enough food, for example, to go around, or there may not be the possibility to run an effective criminal justice system to protect people. But insofar as we can realize human rights through the design of social institutions, we have a responsibility to do at least that much. Obviously, more will be required. Most people will say that justice requires more than just the fulfillment of human rights. But I think most would agree that human rights are a minimal conditions. And insofar as we run a society with institutions that foreseeably and avoidably do not realize human rights, one can say we are harming people. We are imposing on them rules that foreseeably and avoidably leave the human rights of many people unfulfilled. Another way of putting that is if you are in the business of imposing a certain rule order on a society, then a minimal condition that you have to meet in order to legitimately do that is that you fulfill the human rights of those people who are bound by these rules, against whom these rules are being enforced. Now, thinking about human rights, we also have to think about human responsibilities, one of the themes of our week here. And with regard to human responsibilities, the responsibilities that are correlative to human rights, we can distinguish three different cases. We can distinguish, on the one hand, human rights underfulfillment, human rights deficits, which are such that really we particularly cannot do anything about them. A very clear-cut example is human rights deficits that existed in the past. There's nothing that we can do now to fulfill the human rights of people who came to grief, for example, during the Second World War. Then there are human rights deficits with regard to which we are bystanders who can do something to help. And here in the language of the United Nations, we have obligations or responsibilities to protect and to fulfill human rights. We now have a famine raging in Africa, as you know, very high death rates, and human rights are definitely not fulfilled. And we have opportunities, perhaps, through effective aid organizations or in other ways, to help fulfill these human rights. And these are responsibilities that, in philosophy, we call positive duties. Positive duties because you have to do something actively to help and protect people. And then we have also negative duties. Negative duties are duties not to violate human rights, not to do anything actively through which human rights deficits come into existence or are aggravated. And one very important and crucially overlooked way in which I think we are often violating human rights is by helping to design or impose institutional arrangements that foreseeably and avoidably create or aggravate human rights deficits. This happens at the national level, but it also happens at the global level with regard to supranational institutions, which in our world are becoming increasingly important as determinants of the life prospects of people around the world. Now, just when you thought I'd said something new and interesting, I have to tell you that this is already in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, where Article 28 says that everyone is entitled to a social and international order in which the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration can be fully realized. It's a remarkable article, and it's very easily overlooked because it sounds like all the other articles. It sounds like another right is being added to the rights that were already listed before, but that's not really the case. This doesn't add a new right. It tells you how the other rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration should be understood, namely not merely as constraints on the conduct of individual and collective agents, such as governments and armies and so on, but also as constraints on the rules that human beings are permitted to impose on other human beings. Now, let's look at the global institutional order for a moment and look at the fact that inequality has tremendously increased over a large stretch of recent history, for a few hundred years to be precise. This increasing inequality has taken on a new face in the last 20 years or so, where the disparity between the developed and the less developed countries is no longer increasing, thanks to very spectacular growth in China.